Thanks for joining us for Dr. Walls Answers Questions about the Walls Protocol.
Hello, this is Dr. Terry Walls with another question and answer session. I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Iowa, where I teach medical students in their primary care clinics as well as internal medicine residents. I see patients with a traumatic brain injury, and I conduct clinical trials testing the intervention of nutrition and lifestyle in the setting of progressive multiple sclerosis. I am a patient with progressive MS. I was originally diagnosed with relapsing remitting MS in 2000. By 2003, despite seeing the best people, I had gone to the Cleveland Clinic, taken the latest, newest drugs. Still by 2003, my disease had transitioned to secondary progressive MS. I took the chemotherapy. I took Tysabri when it was available. I expected to follow the conventional wisdom, which is that I would gradually decline. By the summer of 2007, I had difficulty sitting in a chair. I needed to be in a recliner or in bed. I could walk short distances using two canes. And that's when I created an intensive nutrition program based on what I had learned from functional medicine, my read of the literature, and hunter-gatherer principles. I created the Walls diet, did massage, meditation, exercise, electrical stimulation of my muscles, and within a year, I was able to walk again without a cane. I was able to bicycle 18 miles. The following year, I did a trail ride with the Canadian in the Canadian Rockies with my family, and the year after that, I wrote a protocol and was able to obtain grant funding to begin doing a clinical trial testing my interventions in others with progressive MS. And we've presented our preliminary data at the 2011 Neuroscience Conference. Now, I have to begin all of my presentations with the following observation. The United States Food and Drug Administration has not evaluated any of the statements or claims made in my books, on my websites, in my lectures, in my presentations. Nor any of these claims intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Their education. I want you to listen, think deeply, talk to your family, your friends, talk to your physician, have your physician and your family decide how to personalize this for you and your family. This is not intended to replace the guidance from a personal physician. I also need to put a pitch out that I invite you to help spread the word that there's a tremendous amount that we can do to restore our health and vitality. It's not dependent on our genes. Instead, it's dependent on the choices you make and I make with the food we eat, the activities we do, the relationships we have. And this is what my research is about. Now, it's very difficult to get funding to continue this kind of work. I don't anticipate the National Institute of Health funding such a complicated study, nor do I anticipate the MS Society funding these kind of complex studies. But I still write grants and submit them, and most recently the critiques said, quote, "Dr. Walls clearly does not understand the pathophysiology of MS," unquote. You know, what I think that really means is that my approach is so radical, so innovative, that it will be very difficult for conventional funding sources to fund my work. It will require you, your friends, your neighbors, your family, to be willing to help pay it forward and support this kind of work. You could buy books, you could buy lectures. You could get supplies for your friends, your family, your acquaintances. You could donate whatever amount that you can would be wonderful. Because it's going to be the community that will decide if this work is valuable enough to continue. If the educational efforts I do, for the public are worth continuing or not. So please, please be part of the team. Please make your contribution to keep this work going forward and to let my team continue to do the research. It costs money. It's $300,000 through the next study that we'd like to do. If we're going to get a study that shows the efficacy of intensive nutrition and lifestyle for MS and other chronic diseases, those kinds of studies would cost $3 million, and we'd need two of them to ask for FDA approval. It will be the public, people like you, who will help make this possible. Now, let me go on with the questions. What do you recommend for low blood sugar issues, food, exercise, lifestyle? Is a reflection that the insulin is spiking very high and there's some level of insulin resistance. How does insulin resistance happen? Chronic exposures to too much sugar, white flour, white potatoes, high glycemic kinds of foods. So my approach then is to have people follow a diet that does not require as much insulin. That kind of diet would be higher in protein, non-starchy vegetables, things like a lot of greens, a lot of sulfur-rich vegetables, cabbage family, onion family, mushrooms, asparagus, berries, brightly colored vegetables such as beets, carrots, meat with every meal, high-quality, healthy fats that haven't been processed, things like coconut oil, animal fats such as lard, tallow, clarified butter or ghee. And then, of course, meditation, massage, exercise. What do you eat when you're having a sugar craving? So when people are experiencing sugar craving, it's a reflection of the level of addiction that we have. And I would say most Americans are addicted to sugar, white flour, high fructose corn syrup, white potatoes. We want that surge of blood sugar in our blood because that will boost the dopamine in our brain, which is tied into pleasure and attention. The best solution, from my perspective, is to go on a diet that does not spike the blood sugar so much, that does not require so much insulin. And that looks like greens, sulfur-rich foods, color, grass-fed meat, organ meat, and seaweed. You won't need as much insulin to keep your blood sugar normal. And it's common when people first start this diet that they will experience some withdrawal. How do you know if you're allergic or sensitive to food? The best way to know this is through what's called an elimination diet, where we take you off all of your foods, put you on foods that are very low likelihood of food allergy, and then reintroduce foods one at a time, ideally every 3 days. Blood tests are not reliable. Skin tests are not completely reliable. There are advantages and disadvantages with each of the tests that are commercially available. And I talk about this in my lectures on food allergies. I will talk about this more in my book, Minding My Mitochondria, and in the next book, The Walls Protocol. Could you provide directions and a recipe, types of bones for making bone broth? You know, our ancestors have been making bone broths for hundreds of generations, maybe thousands of generations. What you need are some bones, preferably bones that have a lot of joints on them. If they are long bones, you can break the bones to get the marrow out. Put them in a pot of water. Add a couple tablespoons to 3-4 tablespoons of vinegar, depending on how large the pot is, to the water. The vinegar draws the minerals out of the bones. I add a teaspoon of powdered seaweed. Then I go to my vegetable drawer and look for any vegetables that are getting past their prime, so I'm not so sure that I want to eat them or serve them to my family, and I throw those in the pot. And I'll add whatever spices that are of interest, and I encourage you to think about your ethnic background and use those spices. They have a great ability to lower the inflammation. And I have that on low all day. You can keep that going for a week or just a day. When you're ready, strain the bones and the vegetables out. You'll have a broth. Now, if while you're making your soup, there's any foaming that comes up, skim off the foam. The fat you can either keep and use for cooking or scrape off. And then the other thing that I like to do is add some powdered gelatin to the broth. So the broth is maximally rich in gelatin. And this broth will be just marvelously good for you. Filled with the minerals that your skeleton needs and your muscles and ligaments need. Filled with glutamine and free amino acids that your muscles and brain need. This is powerfully, powerfully potent medicine. If taste is not a consideration, would you still recommend a variety, varying the types of greens, or to eat kale daily, since you say it has the highest nutrient value? My recommendation is to rotate your greens. Greens have tremendously good nutrition for us. They, like all plant materials, have some things that are not so good for us. And that's part of why having variation in your diet, so you're rotating through different food groups every day, is so very helpful to you. What are the best kale alternatives? When I talk about the food groups, green leaves, sulfur-rich vegetables, and bright colors, I want you to look at what's growing in your locale. It's best to have greens that are obtained locally as opposed to greens that have been transported 1,000 or 1,500 miles. So don't get hung up on whether this is kale or spinach or romaine lettuce. Look for green leaves that are grown in your area. And for the sulfur-rich vegetables, again, you can talk to chefs within your culinary tradition and ask which vegetables are rich in sulfur. And those are the vegetables that give you gas that college boys would light because it's the methane-producing gas. Do you suggest diving into this diet immediately or gradually? So if you're in my clinical trial, you have 14 days to get the study diet done correctly, perfectly, for those 14 days. So everyone who's in my study makes an abrupt change from the standard American diet to our study diet. And many of them will experience some withdrawal from that sugar and high fructose corn syrup and white flour. They'll have some detox reaction. So that first week might feel very tough. Typically, by the second week, things are turning around. They often note that the cravings have greatly diminished. In my clinics, my clinical style of practice is that I give people information, and then I ask them to tell me what they learned and what their goals are, because I want patients to determine their own goals, because that's what they can realistically achieve. So some of my patients go home, purge their cupboards from all the forbidden foods, and do this pretty much bingo, boom, all at once. I would say far more common, though, is the gradual winding down of the bad food and winding up of the good food. But every circumstance is different, and I encourage you to talk to your family members and have a negotiation so that everyone is on board and agreeing with the timeline and the speed that you're planning on making the change. Not much appetite. Any recommendations? So when someone doesn't have a lot of appetite, I have to wonder in my clinic what might be contributing to that. And so there may be some history, a physical exam, and laboratory testing that I would do to understand, are there nutrient deficiencies? Are there toxins? Is there another illness going on? And I think that's a very important consideration. How much does sugar interfere with the diet that you suggested for MS and other diseases? The evidence continues to grow that sugar is a toxic substance, that it damages how our cells do the chemistry of life. It drives up insulin, it confuses our hormones, it creates addiction. It leads to high blood pressure, it leads to high cholesterol, clogging of the arteries, diabetes, heart disease. It also dramatically increases the risk of autoimmune problems, mental health problems. I'd say it's very much like alcohol and the nicotine. At some point, our society will have to come to terms with the need to regulate and tax sugar because of the toxicities and damage it's causing to people individually and to the public health. How does a thin person avoid weight loss? So people often lose weight on our protocol. And as that happens, we increase the healthy consumption of fat and increase the consumption of meats. Can you speak about the test for sensitivities, allergies, and tolerances? All of the tests have some problems. You know, and I talk about this extensively in my food sensitivity allergies lectures, but there's no perfect test. The gold standard is the elimination diet. And I talk about the elimination diet in these concepts quite extensively in the food allergies lecture. What are your thoughts on dried fruits? So berries and dried fruits have more natural sugar, fructose, in them. And the dried fruits are more likely to be sticky onto your teeth, increasing the risk of dental cavities and caries. Having some dried fruit along with sprouted nuts can be a helpful snack on-the-go food that really is quite healthy for you. But I would limit that to one serving a day, and this is not one cup of dried fruit. It'd be more like 2 tablespoons. Of dried food. Can you get enough calcium through the Walls diet to discontinue calcium supplements? So again, prior to making changes in your vitamin and supplement regimen, I would have you speak with your physician who got you started on the vitamins and supplements and have them help give you personalized guidance. Some of the best and most readily absorbed calcium and minerals that you'll get will be from bone broth. When I broke my arm, for the first month I had 2 quarts of bone broth every day, which I gradually tapered down to a cup of bone broth, which is my usual maintenance. It's very important to have plenty of vitamin D. And I talk about the issue of vitamin D and minerals in great detail in the vitamin D and minerals lecture. And I suggest that you go there for more information. I've been following Dr. Budowitz's cancer cure with daily flax oil and cottage cheese. Is there a cottage cheese substitute? So Dr. Buttigieg was a fat scientist who observed that the omega-3 fats are very, very important to the body in many, many biochemical steps that our body makes and our cells make. She created a compound by blending cottage cheese and flax oil that made this, in her mind, more available to the body. And I have had a subject who is doing quite well in our study start this flax oil, hemp, or flax oil and cottage cheese supplement, and she got worse. Remember, cottage cheese is dairy, and we told her that she needed to stay off dairy. She got back, cleaned up her diet, got back off that flax oil, and things began turning around. Flax oil your body has to convert the flax oil through a fairly lengthy process to make the two compounds that our cells need, eicosapentaenoic acid, which is EPA, and docosahexaenoic acid, which is DHA. Those compounds we can make out of the flax oil omega-3s, but it's about a 5 to 7% efficiency rating. I'd say it's much more important to get DHA and EPA. You can get that from fish oil supplements, cod liver oil supplements, wild fish. Is there an allergy testing company that you recommend? I discuss the issue of food allergies a great deal in the food allergy lecture series I have. And I'd really recommend that you listen to those lectures if you want to have a deeper understanding of food allergies. Well, what about homemade kefir? So yogurt, kefir, cottage cheese made from dairy will still have the casein. This is still a relatively new food. For 2.5 million years, humans ate roots, berries, meat, fish that we could find, eggs seasonally, and seafood. It was about 10,000 years ago that we started having dairy, and it was raw dairy. And I will certainly agree that raw dairy is safer than pasteurized, homogenized dairy. But that's a relatively new food, and many people will find that they do far better if they give up the dairy. Now, there are cultured products that I've made and that you could probably purchase. And there's cultured almond yogurt, cultured soy milk yogurt, cultured coconut milk yogurt. Now, as many of you know, it's my preference that you use either coconut milk or almond milk. There are many potential problems with soy, the most common one being that it's a genetically modified organism. And people are far more likely to have food allergies when you're consuming a genetically modified organism. Can you explain a leaky gut? Yeah, I talk about this in detail in the Trouble in Your Gut lecture. What happens with a leaky gut is that you set up circumstances where the cement that holds the cells together in the small bowel and also in your blood vessels and lining your brain, that's called the blood-brain barrier, that the cement holding those cells together has become fragile, somewhat leaky. It's a bit like drilling hundreds, thousands of holes in your roof, the rain will get through. In the case of your small bowel, that means is food that's not completely digested escapes into the bloodstream, where it will confuse the immune cells that are sitting there inspecting the food that comes over particle by particle. And as that happens, that leads to an overactive immune response. And if that continues, the person is then primed to develop autoantibodies and begin attacking self. Is a slight decline at first normal? Yes, that's exactly what one can expect to see with any kind of illness, whether it's multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, Parkinson's disease. Is it possible for me to consume too much vitamin A or omega-3s? You know, absolutely. As soon as you begin taking supplements, you run the risk of getting things out of proportion. So if I'm taking lots of fat-soluble vitamins, D, that the receptors that bring in the fat-soluble vitamins will bring in several of the vitamins. And so if you have a very high level of vitamin D, that could compromise your ability to bring in vitamin A. It is one of the reasons why, if you're taking supplements, it's very helpful to have someone who understands nutrition to help monitor, to see to it you don't create some inadvertent nutritional deficiencies. It's also why I stress the critical role that food is absolutely the most important. Can vitamin supplements replace the nutrients in red meat? I'm guessing this person is a vegetarian and would like to not eat meat. There are a wide variety of reasons people choose to not eat meat. Sometimes it's for health. Sometimes they don't want to kill animals. Sometimes it's really a very deep religious, spiritual reason. I do make the observation that without vitamin B12, you can't make nerves properly, and you're more likely to have problems with myelin leading to neuropathies, leading to memory and thinking problems. The societies that have gotten along without eating meat had some spoilage in the rice and beans, which allowed the vitamin B12 to get made during that spoilage process or fermentation. If one elects to be vegetarian, it's certainly going to be prudent to have your B vitamin levels monitored to be sure that you're getting an adequate amount of B vitamins in the diet. What's an algae that we can get somewhere else? Algae is a great source of chlorophyll and a number of vitamins and minerals. So during the summer, I go out and get greens from my garden, put in through my Vitamix, and that's my very potent green drink. When I travel, I'll take algae. During the winter, I will use algae since I don't have as many garden greens to blend up. Can we be certain, boosting digestive hydrochloric acid with supplements and cider vinegar drink prior to a protein meal? Yes, there are reports that has been quite helpful. How can we be certain we're consuming enough calcium and B vitamins? Well, the most effective way to know is to have a detailed nutrition analysis that looks at your vitamin stores and your mineral stores. Do you have any advice for people who are addicted to sugar and want to end their addictions? You know, it's the same advice I give people who are addicted to tobacco, drugs, alcohol. We talk about the addiction, setting up a quit time, having control of the environment so you remove the compound to which you're addicted from the environment, and you socialize with people who will support not having sugar. And of course that's tough because we're in a society that is sugar addicted and it's everywhere. What role do grains play in a healthy diet? Now, there are a number of diets that show benefits as compared to the standard American diet. Vegan, vegetarian, Mediterranean, paleo diet, and the Wallace diet. What they all have in common is that they reduce sugar, reduce processed foods. My perspective is the Walls diet has the historical basis or the roots in how our societies ate for millions of years. Plus, guidance from functional medicine and the basic science on brain science so that we know how to reconstruct the diet to make sure I'm getting the 31 nutrients that my brain needs. So, what roles do grains play? Grains, I think, are anti-nutrients. They're much more likely to get you into trouble than provide anything that's beneficial. There are people who have great health, no chronic disease, at ideal body weight, who can consume some whole grains without much problem. I don't think that's the optimal diet. What foods should be avoided by people with hypothyroidism? I think that's a conversation to have with your treating physician, personal physician. From my perspective, many with hypothyroidism actually have a low iodine and need to increase their iodine, selenium, and trace mineral intake. Suggestions for somebody with TMJ who has difficulty chewing: lots of raw veggies. Make smoothies, make soups. How critical are organ meats and seaweed for healing the brain? There continues to be evidence that humans evolved. We grew our big brains because we were next to the sea and we're eating a lot of seaweed and seafood, which are critical structures for growing that big brain. And there's evidence that over time, particularly as our diets deteriorated, the size of our brains has declined. So I think it's important to have organ meats. I think it's important to have seaweed. I think it's important to have seafood. How can I get my children to eat paleo when they're surrounded by mainstream foods? Boy, that is a tough, tough question. Admit what are your limits to your control. So in your home, you could take out all the bad food and replace it with food that is good. Talk to your family, talk to your kids. Restore your own health and vitality. And realize that your kids will become adults, they'll make their own choices. What you can do is create the environment that makes it possible for them to choose healthy foods, get rid of the unhealthy foods, and talk nonstop. They are under constant barrage to eat food that tastes good, to which they're addicted, and unfortunately will destroy their health. Are there studies that compare a paleo diet to a Mediterranean diet? Yes, there are. Paleo diet had, as they were comparing how satiated the person was, whether they ate paleo or Mediterranean, and the effect on blood sugar, blood pressure, and some markers of inflammation and insulin sensitivity. And what they saw was it was easier to lose weight on the paleo diet than it was on the Mediterranean diet. And by the way, that Mediterranean diet is far healthier than the standard American diet. I noticed in my human mitochondria, there's still many recipes that are not paleo. Why is that? I think I should have made it much more clear, and it will be far more clear in the next book, that I understand many people will make a gradual transition from the standard American diet, and then increasing their vegetables, trying to get rid of the sugars, and then the next step will be going gluten-free, dairy-free, and trying to figure out how to have many of these familiar carbohydrate-based meals, but at least on a gluten-free basis. And then the next step will be going more fully paleo. I was not as clear in my mitochondria, but we will be much more clear in the next book. What adaptations do you recommend using with kids, tween, young teenagers? I think this adaptations goes for anyone in your family. You're going to need to talk about food, talk about the toxic effects of sugar, talk about the addictions that we have to the additives in food, the excitotoxins that are creating addictions, attractions, and are damaging our health. And then go through your home, take out the bad stuff, replace it with good stuff. Have vegetables, fruit, meat at every meal. And talk about why you're serving this. That will be very important because those kids will grow up and they're going to make their own choices at school. They'll make their own choices with friends. In my family, my son has asthma and some acne, which went away completely when he went gluten-free, dairy-free. And because he doesn't have an acute response, when he moved off, he found it difficult to maintain the gluten-free, dairy-free. And we can tell because he'll have acne up on his face and his allergies will be a problem. And he struggles. He wishes that he had an acute feedback because when he has his indiscretions, things come on more gradually. My daughter, on the other hand, has a terrible migraine that is so bad she'll be throwing up. She will be in her room with a pillow over her head, and she might be like this for 3, 4, 5 days. So she's learned to read labels, look very carefully, and think long and hard before eating food. And so she keeps her diet really quite clean. And for me, if I have a dietary indiscretion, and this will happen more likely if I'm going out to eat, you don't know what the sauces are that are on these various foods, and that's where the gluten can be in sauces and in salad dressings. So if I end up with some gluten, I'm much more likely to have a flare of my face pain. And of course, that is extremely miserable. And so I've learned to pay very close attention, ask waiters to make sure I know what I'm getting. And, you know, frankly, I'm grateful that I have an acute, miserable response because that makes it easy for me to stay on track. In our clinical trial, the people who have an acute, miserable response find it much easier to stay rigid on the diet than the folks who have a much slower response. And the unfortunate thing there is people will gradually begin adding that food that tastes so good, to which they're allergic, to which they are addicted. And instead of steadily improving, their diet steadily erodes, their fatigue gradually gets worse, their walking gradually deteriorates. And then we see them again, go through their diet and have a pep talk about why they need to tune up their diet, and then show them videos from, so they could see the level of improvements that they had been getting, which now got lost when they became less pristine on their diets. But it is a challenge because we are all addicted to that delicious food. You know, I love homemade bread. I love pie. I love cheese. I love yogurt. And I'm addicted just like everyone else. But on the other hand, I really like running. I like being able to bike. I like writing books and lecturing. And I am so blessed that if I have an indiscretion, I'm likely to have a flare of my pain, face pain, and that makes it far, far easier for me to stay completely, completely good on the diet. So, you know, once again, if you find the education that I provide helpful, if this is help restore your health and vitality to you or a family member, please pay it forward so that others can enjoy this. For physicians to understand the power of nutrition, they need to see clinical research published in top-tier journals. That means I need more research protocols. I'll have to pay staff. We'll need to pay for the lab tests. It's expensive. The next study that we'd like to do is $300,000. That would be a small test pilot study. To do a study that would look at efficacy, that would be a larger study requiring two sites. That's $3 million. And sadly, I think we're going to have a tough time getting the National Institute of Health to complete such a study. I'm still writing grants, still making submissions. But, you know, what I'm hearing is that the NIH and the MS Society are being far more conservative with their money. They don't want to test support anything new, and they want studies that have one little intervention. They're not trying multiple interventions such as we are. So if this is going to work, if we're going to see clinical research testing the benefits of a paleo-style eating plan, the benefits of intensive nutrition, massage, meditation, exercise, e-stim, then it will only happen because of people like you who think it's worthwhile, who are willing to support the cause by buying more books, more lectures, getting them to friends, family, acquaintances, donating to the Walls Foundation or to the Walls Research Fund. That is how we'll get the next study going. And that is how we'll change the course of medicine. But for physicians and nutritionists to be able to recommend this kind of intervention, they need to see published literature. For published literature to happen, we absolutely need to have high-quality research studies. And though I've donated hundreds of hours to this effort, and I have students donating hundreds of hours to this effort, we do need to have some paid staff. We do need to pay for our safety labs. And it's going to cost a lot of money. If you don't want this stuff to die, folks, please, please, please become part of the team. Support the efforts by buying books, buying lectures, and making donations. And let me remind you that this is education. This is not intended to replace the guidance from a personal physician. And nor are any of these statements intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Only FDA-approved drugs, diet, devices can make such claims. Someday, however, with your help, we'll be able to raise $3 million so we can do studies and apply for FDA approval for this type of intervention. To do that, we'll need you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us for Dr. Walls Answers Questions about the Walls Protocol.